for example, not on the ground, aerial and vertical antennas. They could be dipoles. The antenna is a dipole, center-fed. It could be end-fed, capacitive end-fed, capacitive end-fed shortened, capacitive end-fed with tuning rods, and yet no grounding. But it does have grounding. The grounding is the earth around it, the near field of ground. Okay, so that works. Then I want to take a quarter wave vertical. Okay, it's part of the dipole. Let me let it drop and come back. The quarter by quarter dipole, the halfway dipole. One leg is bent up, one leg is bent out. Nice. You know, that could work in a specific direction only. It's going to have a beam width. I add more radios. In the air, quarter wave above ground for that. And I now have an omnidirectional ground plane antenna, aerial mounted. I've done that. Do that with a multi-band vertical antenna. And guess what? There's a lot more factors to consider. I'll be quick, let me come back. If I'm doing this with traps at the high end of the antenna, which are more efficient, and I want to do it with three bands, do I always tilt each of the quarter wave ground planes at 45 degrees, achieving 50? No. All of my near field ground changes that. I could have some of them at 90 degrees. I could have some of them at 30 degrees. I could have some of them at 40 degrees. Not only is the near field ground affecting it, but those horizontal ground plane radials are affecting each other. So I gotta play with it until I get it right. Then I find out that it is the far field ground that's going to give me the DXing or the distance that I needed from that tuned conductor.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, John.
Boy, I think you're one of the few people here that really understood my question, and thank you. I'll let it go with that. And I just want to say that, you know, many people have commented on things like impedance and 72 ohms and it's 50. Well, those impedances can all be handled. You know, we can build a matching network with coax, et cetera, and really the only reason we talk about that impedance is just to have efficient power matching so that we get the full power to the antenna. So we're past that, and we're just talking ideally. We got that all covered. We got that all covered. Doesn't matter if it's in space. Doesn't matter if it's here. We got it all covered. Whatever matching network to the antenna, so we have peak energy transfer. Let's just say we got that covered. But Roy, the bottom line is I wondered if I missed something, and I've listened to you many times. You're a very knowledgeable guy. I'm an EE. I've done Maxwell's equations. Three dimensions, they don't scare me, I understand them, but I've just never seen an explanation of the vertical, and like the last gentleman was talking about, we could do this, we could do that, that's my whole argument. We could, it's sort of like when penicillin was first discovered. All they knew was, you know, when it has this effect, it works. We don't know why, but it works. And it wasn't until many, many years later, in decades, with microscopes and analyzing what was really going on, that we understood why it works. So, all right, I'm going to let it go with that, Roy. I'm satisfied because I just don't think it's, and I said it from the beginning, I don't know if anybody really does. I'm sure there's maybe one guy out there that really understands, like you said, that it can be broken down into a picture or a calculation.
Hey, I appreciate it. Like I said before, they have a method of explaining it. Whether it's the final answer or not, I don't know. And as far as I am aware, there is no equation that you can use for it, no matter how complicated it might be. Because I'm sure there are very clever amateurs out there with EE degrees, and PhDs, and all kinds of fun stuff, and they would dredge it out on the pages of amateur radio publications and websites and show it for everyone to see. So there is no fun equation, to my knowledge, that goes into the specifics. And as George mentioned, and as Ed mentioned, it's an experimental phenomena at this point. The underlying mirror effect might be legitimate, but it doesn't lend itself to any mathematical conclusion. But I thank you for bringing up a very interesting topic for tonight.
KD2FIU.
George.
Roy, thank you for letting me in tonight to give my 3 minutes or whatever. And I want to thank Ed also here for bringing up Dr. Krause, H-A-K, W-H-A-K. And I've read some of his articles and books. And I've also read, have the books on Antenna Designs by Stanley. These are two old books that I have, and that's the way I build my antennas. I don't go with anything that is going to be computerized into like pure space for me. Those are very experimental type of books. And by the way, Dr. Krause at WHAK, he experimented with directivity and rejected a rejection on alternate phasing, not compounded phasing, which is a different theory altogether. Roy, thank you. KD2FIU.
You're welcome, George. Anytime you want to come up to the microphone and say your piece. I'm curious, have you read Rothamel's antenna book? It originally was written in the German. They came up with an English edition that's very fascinating to read.
No, I have not. I have not, and I've got to yet learn how to spell that name that you put to me right now. I have not gone that far, and I'd be interested because to me, most of the experiments that were conducted between the 1930s and around 1960 are really what people now are putting into their programs to help people design antennas. And if I get into some of these old books, which I have, and not just one book, it's also articles. I have done Dr. Krause, W-H-A-K, and also Stanley, and also Bryce, B-R-I-C-E, and to some of his antenna designs, which were from the late 1950s also. It covers anywhere from the initial science of quantum physics as to how electromagnetic fields and the electron flow are transferred back and forth. And this is not an entirety, but as far as transferring it to a conductor, these older books give you a better understanding to say that you have a tremendous amount of flexibility to build the conductor, the antenna, and just go with it. You know, it's just like go with the flow. And I would like to know how to spell the name of that German name off that you were offering there. KD2FIU.
Yes, George. It's Rothamel, R-O-T-H-A-M-M-E-L. Rothamel's antenna book. You can probably pick it up on Amazon, I would think.
And that's a confirm. Thank you, Roy.
Doc. Tell that again, Roy. Patient. Let me see if I still have Jim, KD2VHT, because we still have a few minutes. So, Jim, do you have a question for tonight?
I do, Roy, but I don't think we're going to get it in tonight. What a very interesting evening. As it turns out, you guys are speaking to exactly what I wanted to ask about. It had to do with NVIS antennas, 80 and 40 meter, Austin to Fed, dual band. I don't think we're going to cover it tonight. Perhaps we can glance on it and come back next week and talk about it.
Okay, Jim, I'm sorry that we got carried away with other subjects and we didn't have a chance for yours. But please come back next Sunday and we'll put you into the first slot. How's that?
Oh, that'd be great. If I make it back, I'll try. But maybe some thinking caps on the concept of what I'm trying to build, a offset to Fed and VIS dipole. That'll handle 80 and 40 meters in the general class phone band. It's an interesting thing. Some people say it can't be done. It seems like a couple of can. Much greater minds than mine on this station tonight. I'd love to hear from them next week.
Okay, very good. We've talked about NVIS in the past. I don't think we've talked about it in relation to an off-center fed dipole. So we can do that. So, we'll see what happens next Sunday. If you're around, so we'll put you on the first slot because we dragged this out until 10:13. Hopefully you'll be able to make it. If not, there'll be other Sundays, and I look forward to discuss it with you.
Excellent. Good night. 73
KD2VHD. Okay, very good. Let me just throw out a relatively simple little puzzle for you people. Another foodstuff puzzle. Which do you think has the higher percentage by weight water content, a watermelon or a cucumber? Unfortunately, that person was 99% noise, so if you could move your antenna, if it's a handy talkie around, or in some way get into the repeater a little bit better and try again.
KD2NVV.
Yes, I hear you. What's your answer for the puzzle tonight?
I'm going to guess it's cucumber. I know they have a lot of water.
Okay, unfortunately, I can't make out what your answer was because there's too much background noise. I guess the easiest thing is to just say Q for cucumber or W for watermelon.
And said cucumber.
Q, we're back.
And I couldn't hear him from here, but so there's a watermelon. Anyone... Was that right, Ed? You said watermelon?
Cucumber.
Oh, okay. Well, you're absolutely positively right. Cucumbers and watermelons actually are very closely related. Watermelons have about 92% water content by weight. And cucumbers have 96% water by weight. So you're absolutely positively correct. Anyone know, just one last one before we call it a night, at least for my segment, how many segments the usual orange has? Most of them have the same exact number, surprisingly, but I wonder if anyone out there ever counted them.
C2CYR. The answer is 8.
WR,
this is
WS2N. I'll go with 13.
Okay, apparently, and I had to look this up because I don't count orange slices either, 10 seems to be the most usual number of slices in an orange. So, who would have known? Anyway, it's been a pleasure. I thank everyone who participated tonight. It was a lively discussion. I don't know if we solved that many things, but we brought up a bunch of things, which is always nice to do. So I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. And it's 10:17, a perfect time to segue over to full WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy, very good. I'm trying to think of this one guy's name, this mathematician. Begin with an F. Fibonacci number. And then it had to do with the flowers, and, you know, everything has the same numbers. Can't think of the guy's name. Do you know what I'm talking about, Roy?
Fibonacci.
Okay, he said Fibonacci, I guess. Very good. That's what I thought you were going with that, Roy.
No, it wasn't a Fibonacci sequence. It's just a happenstance of genetics, developmentally, the way that oranges produce their segments. They produce them usually 10 segments in each fruit.
Very good. Okay, I thought this Fibonacci guy was part of that. Okay. Let's see. Put my high power here. Stand by. Okay. I better stay on mid-range. Otherwise, I'll be cooking this radio by the time we're done here. Anyway, this is WS2N Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet, and let me just start over with launches and landings. Early in the morning, Dr. Kate Rubin's astronaut returned from space with two Russian cosmonauts. Soyuz spacecraft landed successfully in the Kazakhstan desert, and sure, glad to be back. She spent another 180 days in space. She did this recently, a couple of years ago. I followed this astronaut. She's the one that did the sequencing, the first one that did the sequencing of DNA in space last time around, and a lot more biology experiments for the last 6 months as well. So anyway, I'm glad to see that them get all three of them get back safe. Officially 7 people back on the International Space Station. We were up to 10, so that's good. You'll have another launch April 22nd, and you'll be back up to 10 again because it's going to launch 4 more people. And this time from Launch Complex 39A in Florida. So you'll be launching out of the 4 people, 3 I am. You have Shane Kimbrough, he's been up before, KE5HOD. He's going to be launching with Akito. Hoshide is, he's got an American call as well, KE5DNI with Thomas Paquette. He's been up, they've all been up before. KG5FYG, he's from Japan. Thomas Paquette is from England, part of the European Space Agency. But the fourth one is Megan MacArthur. She does not have a license, unfortunately, so we don't have all four like last time, all four that went up on the Dragon crew vehicle, Wolverham. This time we have re-up for Bob Benkin. Bob Benkin, K5GGX, went up last year at this time, May. He went up with Doug Hurley for the first test flight of the Dragon crew vehicle. The test of it, make sure everything worked. Before he came back, and now his wife is going this time around. She's actually going to be in the same seat he was when they flew last time. But they'll be up a lot longer. This is back to the 6 month rotation, so they'll spend some time up there. That's the the latest for launches and landing. They do have. Another Soyuz going up soon as well. Well, actually, that went up. Correction, that went up. We had 10. Yeah, we dropped down to 7, and now we're going to go back. Correction. Losing track now. We had 10. 3 came back. That's 7. And now you have one more going up. Okay, this time now we're going to have 11 people on the space station for a little bit. Anyway, a lot of hands anyway, so that should be good for Aries for the international amateur radio group. You know, Russians are hams as well, so they use the ham station on the ZESR module, the Russian module. And we have our ham station on the Columbus module on the space station. So there's 2 ham shacks up there. There we go. And we'll continue to follow the space station as we have the list. Well, I've been following it since it went up in 1998. But since I've been on the radio, I've been listening to people talk about it, including myself, and listening to yours. Anyway, we have Ingenuity. It's also in the news now. Ingenuity is the helicopter I've talked about many times here on the net that flew up with Perseverance, the rover that successfully landed on Mars in February 8th. And Ingenuity, the helicopter, was on the belly of this thing since it has landed. First month or two is dedicated to this helicopter. They had to get rid of the dust cover that was underneath the rover to expose the helicopter. They needed to break a couple of clamps that were held it down. They do that with pyrotechnics, little guillotine cutting devices. And sure enough, the rover has pitched down, and all 4 legs are looking down. They've disconnected it from the rover. The rover is pulled out of the way. And they've tested the blades. They were gonna fly it about a week or so ago, and they spun up the blades, not to top speed, but they wanted to spin up the blades to make sure everything was working, which they did, but then it had shut down automatically. It aborted in the middle of a test, and the reason for it is it was getting confused with the 2 different software programs that are on the helicopter. One is for flying all the way to Mars on Perseverance. That's one program. It has and then there's the actual program, flight program. Apparently, there's some kind of a glitch there. Well, they fixed that. They sent up a patch or a computer program a couple of days ago. They've tested everything back here on Earth on a matching unit, made sure everything was good to go. So now they're going to test. They're going to fly. First time another vehicle will actually take off on another planet using any kind of a propeller system. And it's going to happen more or less right after this net tonight.
around 3 o'clock, I think 3:15, 3:16 in the morning, it will be taking off. It's all programmed to do that. It's not being controlled by Earth. Mission Control has nothing to do with it. They've already set up the software and the instructions on what to do, and it's ready to go. So, I think around 3:15 tonight, should be flying for about, they think around 45 seconds. It could go up to 90 seconds, but for the first try, they're just going to fly it up, have it translate a little bit, turn a little bit, and come back down and land on its four legs. If it's successful, they'll do this over and over again in the future, but right now, this is the test flight, first time ever. We won't know if it's successful until around 6:30 this morning. That's when all the data will be transmitted back to Earth, back to, in this case, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They're the ones that's handling this. But they have communication set up between the helicopter. It's got to go to the rover. The rover has to send it up to the orbiting spacecraft, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And that will eventually send it back to Earth, to the Deep Space Network. So it starts off with 915 megahertz. They transmit between the rover and the helicopter. That's what they use. Something called Zigbee Communications Protocol. I'm not familiar with that yet. I'm trying to learn a little bit about it. Apparently, it's sort of like, your Wi-Fi setup in your house. You're not going to get a terrific amount of range out of it. In fact, they predict only around 3,000 so feet, and that would be it. If the helicopter went beyond that, they would lose their communications between the rover and the helicopter. Of course, it's not going to do that. They plan on always pretty much staying pretty close to the rover. But that's what they transmit on, 915 megahertz over to rover, and the rover transmits UHF, 70 centimeters up to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter will in turn transmit back to the Deep Space Network on the X-band, 8 point something gigahertz that they transmit back to Earth. And then we'll know, 6 o'clock or 6:30 this morning, and sometime during the day, if successful, probably even if it's not successful, they plan on having a news conference at NASA tomorrow. So I'll be looking forward to that. Let me drop it for any questions.
WG2EAD.
B2EAB. EAB, go ahead. EAB, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button. I screen off to Never Never Land. Okay, I'm coming for a Zigbee. It's another one like Wi-Fi or, Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. They're all like the family of these data links. And it's another one, and I've never actually used it, but I've come across several outfits that are using it. Now, let me be very silly. Quote, don't tell me they're using 915 megahertz. Isn't that air traffic control for the flying saucers if they come in to land on Mars?
Yeah, well, they're using that because they know that, most jammers don't know anything about 915 megahertz, I guess. They definitely don't want to get any kind of harmonics between transmitting to the rover, and the rover eventually transmits up to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So they do have completely different band, which is weird. They could transmit from the Deep Space Network on the X-band directly to the rover if they have to. But they could also transmit to the orbiting satellites. We have a couple of them up there that we use. Mars Odyssey is still up there. They've been using that. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, of course, that's the main one. We also have MAVEN that they can use. That's on an elliptical orbit, but they can use that as well. And another one that's set up for transmissions, we have a deal with European Space Agency with the Mars Express. But they're all, you know, they go up on UHF and out on X-band. Any other comments? Anyway, I hope this thing works. You know, you read about this for years on end, and I'm sure all the scientists, you know, I'm psyched. The engineers that were involved with this are really gonna be very happy if this thing is successful. I think it was only a $25 million project that they started with. And, you know, the whole rover is billions of dollars. I think it's $2.4 billion. But I think the helicopter is only around $25 million or something to build 4-foot-long rotors. The tips of the rotors are going to be going so fast, they're going to be almost, you know, breaking this sound barrier. I think it's just 0.7 Mach. The rotors are going to be spinning at 2,400 RPMs, and they could adjust that. They could make it go a little faster or slower, depending on the density of the air at the time. So this is really involved. So, good luck to them. Anyway, we'll move on to another interesting thing I found here. Yeah. This company called Blue Origin, run by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos of Amazon. He owns that Blue Origin. Well, they've been trying to get this new Shepard off with people for 2015 now. New Shepard is a rocket with one engine. It's got a B3 engine in it, which is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And it takes off vertically from Van Horn, Texas. That's where they're located. Western Texas. They take off. They get up to around the Kármán line. Right before the Kármán line, the engine shuts down. That's MECO main engine cutoff. With that, the spacecraft itself separates from the booster. And the booster comes back down. That's a vertical landing. So it's a vertical takeoff, vertical landing vehicle. And they've done that many times. This was the 15th flight. They've gone through, I think, four different iterations of this rocket called New Shepard. Anyway, before it launched, they put people inside to check out the communications and other equipment between, you know, sitting on top of the rocket and mission control to see if everything was okay, and it was. Yeah, let the Houston ID go by. Anyway, it was successful. The temporary crew got out of the hatch, launched the rocket, went up to the Kármán line. The main rocket came down. The spacecraft itself came down with three parachutes, and then landed, you know, maybe a couple of miles away from where they took off from. So these new suborbital flights, don't go fast enough to make it to orbit. They only get up to around 2,800 miles per hour. But enough to get into what they consider space. The Kármán line is 100 kilometers, you know, or roughly 60 miles.
then they figure out the exact amount of feet. I think it went 360,000 feet up. So they're ready for putting somebody in here. I think maybe not next time, but maybe the time after that. They'll probably put two astronauts on this thing. Well, once it's up and running, they're going to be putting six people in at a time with no astronauts, just six paying passengers. I mean, that's the goal. It's kind of weird. You know, I would want to get in there. I would definitely want to at least one astronaut in there, supposedly flying this thing. I mean, it's all autonomous. Nobody's going to be flying anything. You know, from, you know, when they hit, you know, 30 seconds to go, the computer take over. It launches itself. If it's going to abort, it aborts itself, gets the height, the booster separates, everything's computerized, and then eventually you come down and land. Right before you land, with parachutes, they have little rocket jets that blow out on the bottom to soften the landing, because you are coming down. They sit around 16 miles per hour, so they have to soften that down even a little bit more. But, you know, that's the speed you're going on the parachute. So, you know, they say it's a pretty soft landing, around 5 miles an hour when you actually touch ground. So we'll see how he does with this. I mean, this has been going on, like I said, since 2015. He does have another rocket and a facility that he's building in Florida. You know, this place called Exploration Park, and he built this massive facility, building big rockets called the New Glenn. It's not going to be liquid hydrogen, it's going to be liquid methane. And eventually they'll be launching that from Launch Complex 36, Blue Origin has taken over that complex. They also took over Launch Complex number 11, too, using 11 to test the rocket engines. New Glenn is going to be big. That's going to be an orbital rocket. In fact, the size of it is almost the size of a Saturn V rocket. I think probably 2022, probably the end of 2022, we'll see our New Glenn eventually launch from Florida. Anyway, any comments or questions on this topic, this is WS2N. Okay, here's an interesting mission I'll be following in the future. In the summer, European Space Agency is going to launch this one satellite. They're going to use their new Vega rocket. They launch three different types of rockets in French Guiana and South America. European Space Agency has a light rocket they launch called the light lift rocket. It's called Vega, and they use the Soyuz rocket. They actually buy Soyuz rocket from Russia, and they launch them from French Guiana as well. And that's what they use for mid-range payloads going up. So they have light mid-range, and then they have a heavy vehicle, which is the Ariane 5. It's soon to be Ariane 6. They're building a new one. That should probably fly at the end of the year. So the light rocket, the Vega rocket, they rebuilt that and they made it bigger. They put auxiliary boosters on it, and they're calling it the Vega C. And its debut mission will be this summer. But on this rocket, their first satellite that they're going to launch in space is called this LARES, L-A-R-E-S, and it's number two. They've done this before, back in 2012. Here's another one that's going to be going up. LARES is an acronym for
laser relativity satellite. Second one, they've done like this. Now, what this thing is, it's a sphere. It's only the diameter of 15 inches. So, with no communications equipment on it whatsoever, and it's made out of tungsten. It's a solid sphere. It's not a, it's a solid sphere from one end to the other. It's a 15-inch thing. Because tungsten is so dense, it's more dense than, it's almost three times as dense as lead. To pick this thing up would be virtually impossible. You'd see this 15-inch ball sitting on the ground. And if you want to pick it up, the Hulk couldn't pick it up. It weighs almost 900 pounds. It's the densest satellite that's ever launched. And it has no electronic communications on it, no antennas, nothing sticking out of it. It's just a perfect sphere. What it does have is it's got over 90 of these corner reflectometers, similar to what the astronauts slept on the moon. If we shoot light or lasers at the moon, they always come back. They'll come back from wherever we launched it. If you launch at a laser at 80 degrees, it'll come back at 80 degrees. You'll see that reflection come back. Corner reflected. Put over 90 of these things in here. They somehow drilled holes into this tungsten thing and set 90 reflectors in here. The idea of it is, now they're going to put it up into orbit. I forgot the orbit. I think it's around, I think they said 8,000 kilometers, whatever. I think it's up there. It's say 600 miles or more up. Anyway, it's in an area where you won't have any rarefied air, so nothing will ever slow this thing down. And, even at that level, there might be, a couple of molecules going by that might slow it down. And they don't want anything to interfere with the speed and travel of this thing. The idea is to have it, just being affected by the gravity of the Earth going around the Earth. And what they're going to do is, they're going to send lasers and bounce it off these corner reflectometers accurately measure this thing down to whatever it is, a millimeter or, some perfected number. With who knows how many decimal points to it. They're going to know exactly where this thing is. And the idea is to test one of Einstein's theories of, what do they call this? I forget what it is, the name for it. Anyway, the orbit going around the Earth gets changed by the spinning of the Earth. So it creates what they call frame dragging. Frame dragging is the gravity well of Earth, moving as the Earth spins, and they want to test this. And they'll be able to investigate this, figure out if this theory by two guys, Lenz and Thuring, they call it the Lenz-Thuring effect, which is this shifting of space as the Earth spins. And there's been other experiments like this, but this is just another one. I got involved with reading this, and very surprised at the density of this stuff. Tungsten. And I've had a little experience with tungsten with welding. It is a very heavy type of metal. We use it
in you know, for welding. You have pig tungsten in their gas welding, so tungsten is the metal that they're using. Put a rod that heats up the work. You know, the idea is not to burn that rod away. You have another rod that you, you know, use as a filler rod. So this is what heats it up, and it has such a high melting point. I think it's over 6,000 degrees. So, you know, heat is not going to change it. And that's one of the things that the scientists want when this thing is going around. They want something that's not going to be affected by heat and cold. This way they could say that, you know, if there's any shift in the measurements with their laser beams on Earth, when they look at this thing going around the Earth, it will not have anything to do with, you know, maybe something sticking out, creating a wobble or something. This is a perfect sphere that's going up. Anyway, it's an interesting thing. I'll be following this when it goes up this summer. Anyway, is there any questions in, you know, regarding this Vegas mission? This is WSUX.
WB2BXL.
Go ahead.
Yeah, very good. How are you, Paul? Perhaps you're going to get to it. Apparently, late on Friday afternoon, SpaceX was awarded the Moon Lander contract for the Artemis mission. Nobody's really sure just how this is going to work. I'm just wondering if you were familiar with that, and we're going to cover it this evening.
Yeah, okay, very good, Frank. You know, I'm very surprised that they did this. But, yeah, what Frank's talking about is NASA has chosen SpaceX to be the company that will use a rocket ship to actually land on the moon with two people, and then stay there for a week, get back in the rocket, and then take off and go into a lunar orbit. You know, I mean, they want to use that as the transition vehicle. Now, apparently, this is a done deal. It's a couple of $1 billion contract that I guess they signed already. I'm kind of surprised at what they're doing. I mean, here's the deal, what they wanted to do. Originally, we're supposed to take an SLS rocket, Space Launch System rocket, launch it from Earth. On top, you have the Orion spacecraft with four people on board. The first stage separates, gets burnt up in the atmosphere. Second stage continues on. You have an exploration stage. Second stage, hydrogen and oxygen as well. Now, this thing flies all the way to the moon. And the original deal a couple of years ago was, okay, it will go into orbit around the moon. It will dock with a Gateway space station that we would have supposed to have put there maybe a couple of years before this all happened. So you got the Gateway space station going around the moon. Orion was going to dock with it. People were going to be on that space station already. The four people that are going to go down to the moon, get into the space station, say hello, have breakfast, whatever. And then they get into another vehicle, a transfer vehicle that would separate from the Gateway station. And it would go down and land on the moon. It was like three companies that were involved in this. You were going to have Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin. He was going to have the lander come down. You know, and that was going to be the what you call the descent module. That would land none of them. And then on the top, you would have an ascent module that's being built by Lockheed. And the crew of four, now this is the crew of four, would get into the spacecraft again, and they would use the Jeff Bezos Blue Origin as a launch pad. So, you know, the top vehicle, the ascent vehicle made by Lockheed, would take off and go back up and dock with the space station. Get into the space station, meet up with all your friends inside of the space station. Four people went on the moon, talk about it. Now it's time to go home. The four people get into the Orion spacecraft. And with the exploration rocket still attached to it, and that would take you out of lunar orbit, leave the space station people behind for the next crew to go to the moon. And Orion would take you all the way back to Earth, 25,000 miles an hour, you know, go through the atmosphere, heat shield, parachute, you know, and land in the Pacific Ocean and get picked up by an aircraft carrier. I mean, that was the plan years ago, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. Then this last administration got the bright idea, well, you know, when to do all this, it would take us around 2028. They wanted to do it before 2024 for some reason. Like 2024 was some kind of magical number. So they said, we're going to land somebody on the moon by 2024. So let's temporarily cut out the gate. We'll just send the Orion spacecraft, you know, with the exploration vehicle attached, you know, the rocket attached to it. We'll send that to lunar orbit, and then we'll have the landing system that I talked about before with Blue Origin and Lockheed, you know, descent module, and the descent module will already be in orbit. Forget about the Gateway space station. That setup will be in orbit. We'll dock with it. We'll send the crew down to the moon, you know, spend a couple of days there, and then come back up, dock with Orion. Forget about there's no space station up there. And then the Orion spacecraft would come back. Now, with no funding, they were going to do all this. They were going to push it from 28 to 2024. And I remember saying 5 years ago, this is not going to happen. There's no way. You know, first of all, funding's not there. And it's definitely not there for the Gateway space station. So now NASA, like Frank says, just made an arrangement. It seems like overnight with SpaceX, you know, they all had their ideas on how they were going to do this. Lockheed, Blue Origin, and then SpaceX. SpaceX says, oh, we'll just land a rocket, you know, one of our Starship rockets, and, you know, we'll use that, and then we'll take off. You know, eventually we'll go back to Earth with that. So NASA says, here's what we'll do. We're going to put one of these Starships in orbit around the moon. And remember, the Starship is 160 feet long and 30 feet in diameter. We're going to put only two people on it. We're going to send a masked Starship down to the lunar surface, but land vertically, you know, which, you know, maybe they'll be able to do. There's no wind, you know, to worry about. They won't need any fins, you know, that they usually use, because this vehicle will never come back to Earth. It's going to take off from the moon with the crew after spending a week there. A crew of only two, by the way. The last one with Orion, NASA's original plan was four. Now, the four people were going to come down. Orion was, you know, in orbit, and that's how they get back. Well, here's a spaceship, a Starship, will take off from the surface, dock with Orion. We'll come back. I mean, that is right now the actual plan. You know, it's so much has to happen. I mean, you talk about engineering that hasn't been done yet. First of all, the starships to launch into orbit, never mind to the moon, you need a booster. SpaceX has not even reached the booster yet. They're still trying to launch the second stage, which is you know, what they call the Starship. Launch four of these things, you know, with little fins on it to be aerodynamic and everything. And they've got, they come back down and they blow up one right after the other. I mean, they actually blew up four of these things so far. And, you know, I'm like, I wouldn't want to ride on that. And NASA was like, wow, that's great. You blew up four of them. Let's pick this company to land on the moon. I don't know what they're thinking. But, I hope this extra money, goes in the right direction. Because now, to do what he's got to do, when I say he, I mean Elon Musk and SpaceX, he's got to take a completed Starship like that he keeps blowing up, put it on top of a booster. Now, this Starship is 160 feet tall. The booster is 230 feet tall. You can add something, I think it's a couple of feet different than the Saturn V rocket. The whole launch, who knows from where? I mean, the FAA is not even crazy about what he's doing now. They keep letting him do it, launching it from Texas. He might have plans on, he definitely has plans on launching it from an oil rig. He bought an oil rig and floating these oil rigs. He's going to float them out into the Gulf of Mexico. And he plans on launching from there. So can you imagine he's got to complete this oil rig launch setup. Booster on there, 230 feet high, 30 feet diameter, with 27 of these engines. So far he's only launched three engines attached to a Starship. Now he wants to put 27 engines on a booster. Put the Starship on top of that with not three engines, but six engines. Three regular engines and then three that will work in a vacuum. And then get to orbit. Now, once he gets to orbit, he's getting to the moon because now you're already getting low on fuel on your second stage. So to get more fuel in it, and to get another Starship with no people in it, just fuel, put that on top of another booster. And then that booster will launch that Starship to orbit, and then these two Starships will dock, the one that's going to have the crew on it, and
that time complete,
and the fuel. By the way, these two boosters are supposed to come back down to Texas somewhere and land vertically. I mean, vertical takeoff, vertical landing. Both these boosters, the first one that sent the one up that's going to have the crew in it, and the second one that launched that's got the fuel in it. All right, now these two Starships now have to dock in Earth orbit and, autonomously. There's nobody up there. And they're going to connect, and one's going to fuel the other one to top it off. Now, the one that went up with the fuel is going to deorbit and come back and land vertically back in Texas. Look at all these launches and things that are involved here. We didn't even leave Earth orbit yet. Now that you have a fully fueled Starship in orbit around Earth, that thing, blasts its way to, they call it TLI, Translunar Injection, all the way to the moon. Now it's got to use its fuel to slow this massive thing down to get into lunar orbit. It gets into lunar orbit. I'm assuming that this now has enough fuel to do two things. It's got to be able to relight its engines to slow itself down to start to deorbit so it could land on the moon. And then when it gets near the surface, it's got to light the engines again to land on the moon. All right, now the crew is happy. They want to get out of this thing. This thing's 160 feet tall. Remember the LEM was like 23 feet tall. They got out of the LEM, they crawled out of a little door, backed out of it, and they went down about seven steps,